Good afternoon, Your Honor. Colin Walker, registration number 28365 on behalf of the Shells. It may please the court. Your Honor, we are here today not because we lost, but because the trial court found that our claims were frivolous and entered an injunction which is far more onerous than was necessary or reasonable. As Your Honors know, this case is about a property dispute over a 2.5-acre parcel of property in Weld County. It is a property that was a former railroad right-of-way. The Shells alleged that they had purchased this property years before, and that the deed that conveyed the property, along with some other property, erroneously omitted this small 2.5-acre property. They asserted reformation claims as well as a declaratory judgment claim regarding the legal description and a claim which was added by amendment later in the case to a related piece of property that's known as the laydown area. The trial court ruled against the Shells, and we're not here to challenge the trial court's order on possession of this 2.5-acre parcel property. We're here to challenge the trial court's award of attorney's fees alleged based on her, in our view, erroneous conclusion that the claims were frivolous, as well as this very extensive injunction. The trial court did not find that the reformation claims were frivolous. The court found that three other claims were frivolous, and yet the trial court ordered the Shells to pay all of the attorney's fees incurred by the other parties, the McCulleys. In addition to that, the McCulleys brought counterclaims, some of which were related to an alleged flow of water from the Shell property, which contained two lakes, to their property. The Shells successfully defended those claims, and yet the trial court ordered the Shells to pay the McCulleys' attorney's fees regarding those claims as well. The trial court attempted to apportion the fees between the various claims in her original order, but she did so in an impermissible method, and I've cited some case law on that in the brief. She ordered that the Shells pay attorney's fees for three out of the five claims, and then the attorney's fees after a certain date. This didn't make sense and led to the absurd result that Shells were actually paying more than the McCulleys incurred. We challenged that at a later date, and the trial court eventually concluded over the McCulleys' objection that she couldn't order us to pay more than the McCulleys had actually incurred. However, we did end up paying 100% of the McCulleys' fees, even though not all the claims were frivolous, and we did prevail or successfully defend some of the claims. In a subsequent order, the court tried to justify that by stating that the claims were inextricably intertwined, and that was based on the Padilla case, again, as cited in our briefing as well as the other side's briefing. There's been extensive briefing on that issue. The Padilla case, that part of the Padilla case is dicta because the Padilla case held that all the claims asserted by that party were frivolous, so which is not the case here.
Mr. Walker, what do you urge is the correct method for determining those attorney's fees? If any are found frivolous, how do you suggest they be apportioned?
If any are found frivolous, they should be... you should follow the Fox case, and I think this is an excellent opportunity for the court to issue a ruling on this. As you can see from the briefing, the Fox case is very recent. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case, and you can see that the Supreme Court put enormous effort into that decision. And what the Fox court held was that you cannot recover attorney's fees that would have been incurred anyway for non-frivolous claims, and that was a case very much like this one, where there were numerous claims, and some of them were found to be frivolous, and some of them were not found to be frivolous, but they were overlapping claims. So if they would have been incurred anyway, you cannot recover them. Here, as I have said in the brief, these claims all related. All of the fees that the McCulleys are claiming would have been incurred anyway. The main claims in the case were really the reformation claims. Now, the McCulleys don't agree with that. In their brief, they say that the real issue is the first claim for relief, which is the one that's based on the legal description in the deed as well as the attachment. Well, that claim was not the main claim. The reformation claims are the ones that involved all the evidence we've discussed in the brief, including Plaintiff's Exhibit 5, which is the sketch by the Carlsons, the sellers, real estate broker, and it says in here, and this is discussed at length in the brief, 50-foot easement added. Well, that is the property we're talking about. So there was plenty of evidence here, and the evidence related for the most part to the reformation claims. Now, there was evidence for the first claim and all the other claims, which I've discussed in the briefs. But the Fox case, to answer your question, Your Honor, should control this. And because these fees would have been incurred anyway in regard to non-frivolous claims, if you find that there were any frivolous claims, and of course we say that there were not, then you should follow the Fox case and hold that because they would have been incurred in other, with regard to the reformation claims, they cannot be recovered.
I guess I have a follow-up question on that. In light of the abuse of discretion standard on attorney's fees, and in light of the court's finding that they were inextricably intertwined, can we find that there was an abuse of discretion, or do we need to defer to that standard of review?
If you adopt the holding of the Fox case, then I don't think it's an abuse of discretion standard. I think it's a legal standard about whether the whether there was a but-for relationship between the fees that were incurred regarding the reformation claims and the fees that were incurred regarding these allegedly frivolous claims. I urge you to follow the Fox case. That was a very well thought out opinion by the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think the Padilla case is not an impediment to you accepting that standard because it just didn't squarely address that issue. It was a different case, and the ruling on the inextricably intertwined is dicta. But as I said before, these claims were not frivolous, and we've discussed the evidence at length in the briefs. But everything from the sketch that I just mentioned to the fact that the Shells had uninterrupted use and control of the property for 6 years without any complaint from anybody, they paid the property taxes, were invoiced by the taxing authorities. So the taxing authorities obviously thought that they owned the land. And the Carlsons never complained, and I could go on and on, but there was plenty of evidence here, including the first claim, which was based on the wording of the deed and the law, really a legal argument more than a factual argument, but still a very legitimate argument. And then in terms of the laydown area claims, the McCulley's own experts agreed that except for a tiny corner of that, the Shells do own it. But the issue here is not whether the Shells were right about their claims. The issue is, should they have been held to be frivolous? And the answer is no. There were, whether you agree or disagree, there was legitimate evidence, there were legitimate legal arguments, and the Shells advanced those. If the trial court disagreed, which of course it did, it had every right to find against us, which, believe me, was bad enough. But to go a step further and punish us for that by ordering $170,000 in attorney's fees should not have happened. The case, we understood that there were arguments on the other side and that it was not a slam dunk, but the law is not that you have to have a slam dunk to file a case.
Mr. Walker, the trial court made considerable findings, credibility findings and other findings, and to the extent that we are evaluating the court's ruling regarding frivolous and groundless, you would agree we're bound by the trial court's findings as long as they're supported by any evidence.
I think you're bound by the trial court's findings, but I think what you should do is to look at the evidence that we presented. The trial court resolved credibility issues against us almost completely. I totally agree with that. But we did present evidence, and if that evidence had been believed, then we could well have won. And in front of another judge, this could have gone completely the opposite way.
And so on the claim with regard to the Burlington Northern right-of-way, the trial court seems to have made a finding that you had every reason to know that this was not part of the deal, that your client was well versed in real estate, legal description didn't include it, et cetera, et cetera. The court went on. What did you have to indicate that your deed did in fact include that land?
Well, the case was a reformation case. What we were arguing,
did you not indicate that your deed itself included that land?
We did indicate.
And what did you have to support that?
The language of the deed did not include another document that was behind the deed, was not incorporated into the deed, and in addition to that, the taxing authorities had interpreted the street address, which was the only thing that was on the deed itself.
And you presented that additional document to the trial court?
Yes, we did. And that was a plaintiff's exhibit, and I think it was a defense exhibit as well. So we did. And that's, keep in mind, is only the first claim for relief, which, you know, the trial court obviously didn't like that claim, and we appreciate that. And I think from the beginning, we thought that the reformation claims were the better claims, but sometimes you argue in the alternative. You're specifically allowed to do that because lawyers and judges all look at things differently. And another judge might have found that claim to be persuasive, but it was supported by evidence, and if the judge didn't like it, that's fine. But again, we shouldn't be punished with attorney's fees because of that. I see my time is running short, so let me turn to the injunction, if I might. Of course, the trial court has discretion to enter an injunction here in a trespass case, as she did, but her discretion is not limitless. And I've cited some case law from other jurisdictions. There isn't much in Colorado, unfortunately, but I think this is a perfect opportunity for the court to issue some rulings on the discretion that a trial court has in issuing an injunction. And some of the case law, as I've said, has held things like an injunction that is so broad that either it abuses the discretion if it is so broad as to either grant a plaintiff more relief than it is entitled to or enjoin a defendant from conducting lawful activities and exercising legal rights. That's exactly what the judge did here. She went way too far. All she had to do was to order the Shells to remove what she found to be trespasses, to comply with the law, to provide full disclosure to the McCulleys, and to retain jurisdiction to make sure that we did it. Instead, she forced the McCulleys trial expert on the Shells, made him pay for it, made him pay for a $100,000 retainer up front. And this is a person that clearly was associated with the McCulleys, was a paid advocate. This is truly a fox guarding the hen house situation, and it's an enormous problem, and it's gone much too far.
Well, excuse me, the judge's order did not direct that person be the engineer on the case, said that the McCulleys had to make a reasonable selection of an engineer. Was it impermissible for the court to order that the McCulleys make a reasonable selection of an engineer?
I think it was. I think that what she could have done is set the Shells to move the things off the property. If she was going to order the McCulleys to make a reasonable choice, she should not have allowed them to employ the trial expert that they used, someone with a clear conflict of interest.
So was this presented to the trial court? At what point was this first presented to the trial court?
Well, after judgment, because we didn't know what she was going to do prior to judgment.
So is that issue in front of us, properly in front of us?
Because we have appealed the judge's order denying our objection to the choice of engineer, and that is before you.
And your motion is before us. Have we accepted that appeal, or is it still pending?
No, that was part of this appeal.
Okay.
Your Honor, I think in terms of the injunction, one of the most persuasive pieces of information in front of you is the cases that the McCulleys have cited. They've obviously looked high and low for cases for injunctions that were similar to this one, and what they found are cases that ordered a trespassing party to remove the property that's alleged to be trespassing, the things that are trespassing, and to provide full disclosure, and then the court made sure they complied. All of them, even the egregious one with the tennis court that was intentionally built on federal land. None of them have done what the McCulleys are asking or what the trial court did today. So she has abused her discretion, and this court should take the opportunity to issue an order that reverses her injunction. I've got a minute left. I'd like to save rebuttal, if I may.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Joanna Keddo, and I've represented the McCulleys in this action since 2008. I want to speak to the injunction first because the judge stated when the objection was made to our choice of engineer, she did a post-trial order dated February 14, 2011, and said the court finds IG to be a reasonable choice and clarifies its order, stating that the court specifically contemplated a system whereby the McCulleys could choose their own engineer to protect their interests. And again, this is the part of the injunction that relates to the McCulleys' own land on which a lake was built, not a simple trespass to remove, not a shed, engineering issues involved, floodplain, flood risk. Weld County permits are necessary. Licensed engineers are required by FEMA and Weld County. So somebody has to engineer this thing, and it's on the McCulleys' own land, that part of the injunction, and I'll call that Project 1 for purposes of this argument.
Why wouldn't it have been sufficient for the court to order that the lake be removed and then full disclosure be provided and then retain jurisdiction to make sure that those things were complied with? Why wouldn't that level have been sufficient?
Well, I think here that the judge was very familiar with the facts after a 10-day trial, and we presented evidence of the failure to pull permits for their initial lake. The Army Corps was not notified. They pulled an after-the-fact permit. They built a septic system, no permit. After the fact, post-litigation, septic system permits pulled. But most importantly, the floodplain is the thing, and it has to be engineered, and I think the court had heard enough, and she'd held in several places in her opinion that she was basing this particular ruling on their pattern and practice of failing to construct the lake in compliance with county regulations and permitting requirements. So
you disagree with the proposition that an injunction should only be as broad as necessary?
No, and I think she was narrowly tailored. And one point I'd like to make too is this is page 28 of the court order, and it's paragraph 5 that involves the Shell's property, and paragraph 4 of this on page 27 is what involves, I mean, this was narrowly tailored in my view. And we asked for detailed injunction given the pattern and practices and given the fact that this is a very invasive trespass. It's a lake, a 10-acre lake, and more than 5 surface acres, and most of the volume was in the floodplain uphill from my client's property. So we did ask her to exercise her discretion, and she was pretty detailed, I believe, in her opinion about saying, I reject the notion this is a one-page, two-sentence type of order. I am going to issue some detail on this injunction given the patterns and practices that she had found.
Ms. Kiddo, do you see a difference between a mandatory injunction and a negative injunction in terms of the exercise of discretion by the trial court?
I think she is issuing a mandatory injunction to the Shells regarding their own property given the pattern and practice. She's saying, and by the way, I don't agree with the argument at all that they're being forced to hire RG. Right now, RG, the engineer, is employed by the McCulleys. It's an unremarkable concept that the Shells need to pay for the removal of their intentional trespasses, and the engineering's part of it, on their own land, which I think of as Project 2. It's the pattern and practice that the judge was trying to get at, the fact that there were no permits for this lake and the ones that mattered for floodplain analysis. We understand they had mining and reclamation permits, but that agency does not oversee ensuring that lakes are safe when building the floodplain.
Does the trial court?
No, the trial court doesn't, but to the extent it was brought to their attention, and we've requested that it be made safe and that there be a framework given the pattern and practice. Now, if the Shells hadn't been proven to have a pattern and practice of flouting regulations and failing to get permits, it would have been a different analysis.
Absolutely. Or if it's not within the trial court's jurisdiction either, then what kind of discretion lies with the trial court to issue a mandatory injunction that seeks to rule upon how it will be done?
I don't think that the judge got into the business of doing that, and I think she was clear not to. I think what she said is that they have to comply with all Weld County laws, and that RG would issue recommendations, and they have. A couple of months after the trial was over, they issued a recommendation to the Shells, 3-page recommendation or so, saying this is how you have to rebuild your lake. But within that, the Shells can hire their own engineers to do plans and specifications of designs, and a directive to follow the law is not overly burdensome. That's what they should have done in the first place and what, in theory, they're required to do.
With regard to the removal of the lake from the McCulleys' property,
yes,
will the Shells have an opportunity to challenge those costs?
They've made several challenges already, and the judge has ruled she wants to hear them at the end. Let the costs be incurred, let the project be completed. And so I'm anticipating a hearing, certainly, a battle of the experts all over again with a.
You're anticipating that the final costs may be disputed and will be in front of the trial court.
The Shells have certainly indicated many times they intend to challenge the reasonableness of the costs.
And as I understand your argument,
I think the Shells are protected by that, Your Honor. By the way, I think that's a protection that she wrote into this ruling.
And as far as the removal of the lake on the Shells' property, your position here is that they would have. They can use whoever they want to do that work.
They can. The judge was very careful in paragraph 5 A and B to say that the engineer chosen will do the floodplain work and work with geotechnical engineers. So our engineer would be in charge of obtaining the sort of the background data, the floodplain surveying. But their engineers can certainly, once they have that data and they have our 3-page recommendation, draw up plans and specifications. They can bid competitively for their own work for the cost of doing that. That's certainly with their own discretion on their own land.
And are they free to ignore the recommendations?
No, I don't believe they are under this trial court order. I think that would land us back in the trial court. And we have a motion hearing on the 8th of March regarding their failure to comply with the 20-foot setbacks, because the lake's at this time 7 or 8 feet from my client's property boundaries and Weld County law says 20. So, you know, there are ongoing disputes, unfortunately.
Engineering costs are ultimately held unreasonable, then who pays those?
The judge has been clear that my clients will.
Okay.
She's been very clear in her post-trial order. But she said she specifically contemplated a system where my clients could choose their engineer to protect their interests on their own land. And so far, the Shells have not been forced. I am down to 8 minutes, and I would like to turn to the subject of attorney's fees if you have no more questions. I think it's important to note that the trial court awarded attorney's fees on 3 separate bases. What I think of as common law abuse of process, the abuse of process statute 1317.102, as well as for slander of title. And it's important to note that for a year, this case was, she awarded all attorney's fees on counts 1, 2, and 3 for defending the Shell's claims against the McCulleys, exactly because up until May of 2009, they had not added the laydown area counts 4 and 5. So all of the resources devoted by my clients to clear land that they rightfully bought, they bought in good faith, they did their research, and there was no reason why they couldn't buy that land, and yet they spent the majority of their resources here defending counts 1, 2, and 3. The laydown area counts, I think it's really surprising to argue that the judge did anything wrong here. She had Rule 105B to follow, and she could not quiet title absent having all of the parties in front of her. And the gravel company to the east was just very clearly never notified about this laydown area or given an opportunity to respond. And nor was there a survey presented to the court. The court simply didn't have anything in front of it other than some very limited testimony from our expert saying he looked at the issue briefly. He was instructed not to put a lot of resources into it because we had disclaimed our interest back in May. But when we found that they weren't going to voluntarily dismiss it and we had to go to trial and have evidence, he looked at it briefly and found that 3 parties were owners. So the trial court could not have quite entitled to the laydown area absent having all the parties, and she dismissed that count without prejudice. So I'm just unclear about why they haven't gone back to court with a survey and named the right party and tried to clear that up. She didn't have anything in front of her to come up with a legal description to quiet title in the laydown area. So those 2 counts were certainly frivolous. Count 1 was an important focus of trial. I mean, we can look back on it now and say, oh no, all the resources were spent on counts 2 and 3. And that's not true. The court specifically, early in the case, I asked them to rule and interpret the deed and enter summary judgment to try and limit costs in this case. And they said no. They said, we're not going to get into the business interpreting the deed. And her opinion says again and again that she found Ed Bristow, who's a licensed land surveyor and a J.J. Moss professor, and he was admitted as a surveying expert, that she found his testimony extremely helpful and credible to understand this legal description. So there was no evidence presented. He was unrebutted. The Shells chose a trial strategy. They had his expert report, I think, 2 months after the lawsuit was filed. We wanted to try and nip it in the bud, and they chose to go all the way through trial with no experts at all, either to rebut our engineering evidence in favor of the injunction or count 1. I don't believe that the deed could possibly serve as evidence because the Shells both testified. They don't understand deeds. They don't understand legal jargon. It's a mystery to them. And so the court, I think, very correctly held that if they don't understand their own deed and they're making allegations that it includes the right-of-way legal description, they need to locate evidence. That's what Rule 11 requires them to do, and the abusive process statute. On counts 4 and 5, I think it's important to note that the court did, on page 33 of its opinion, state that counts with constructive or actual knowledge of the 2002 survey, and therefore without substantial justification for counts 2 and 3 of their complaint. That is exactly why she awarded attorney's fees for our defense of those two counts. She made those findings. You've read the opinion. It's replete with, you know, the opinions of the bad faith and the malice and the expansion of proceedings. The court got it right here because she definitely did not abuse discretion. The post-trial fees, if I could turn to our cross-appeal briefly, we've requested that this court reverse the trial court on the limited aspect of post-trial fees. And the reason is that the whole point of remedying an intentional tort is to make the non-trespasser whole. And without post-trial fees, which have been ticking away for the past year, the McCulleys absolutely cannot be made whole in this action. We have cited the Dubray, the Walker decision, Levy-Wagerson, Carl v. Dan Coleman. All of these cases involved cases where the court found an underlying base statutory basis for awarding attorney's fees, such as the Wage Claim Act, or such as 1317-201 for dismissals, or ADA claims. And then they said post-trial motions or appellate fees are appropriate without finding that each and every post-trial decision is frivolous. If you're awarded at this level and you need to be made whole, you're allowed to recover post-trial fees as well. So I think her findings of bad faith, intentional tort, malice, expansion of proceedings, those findings are inconsistent with this case law. I think she erroneously believed she had to analyze each and every post-trial motion for frivolousness, and I think there's record support and combined with these cases to hold that post-trial fees should be awarded. And the Shells have argued that these fees would have been incurred anyway as we worked through to implement the injunction. I absolutely disagree. I think there should be an incentive for the Shells to stop challenging the injunction, follow the recommendations, let the work happen, pay for it. All of this just continues to tick upward and upward, and a party cannot be made whole absent that. On the appellate fees issue, I wanted to state that we do believe that this is a frivolous appeal, frivolous as argued, frivolous as filed, a number of misstatements in the briefs, and just the focus on all the credibility determinations in their brief is not what this court is intended to do. You're not supposed to be revisiting all of those. The arguments that Chappelle doesn't bind to this case and the misinterpretations of that. This case is one of those that's one of the rare ones, and especially where the court's already awarded fees under Section 1317-102, appellate fees are appropriate at this level as well. I also want to speak to the idea of apportionment in the Fox Supreme Court case that was cited by Mr. Walker. That case held that apportionment is not meant to be a exercise in perfect auditing, that it's supposed to be rough justice. I think this court here recognized that counts 1, 2, and 3 were all slander of title. We prevailed on our slander of title, and that was a special damages award, and separately the award of attorney's fees for abusive process, and the abusive process statute was for 3/5, and that's how she got to 100%, and I think it made sense. She was careful to knock off $5,000 in motion to compel motions that we had to file simply to just get a survey and discovery in this case. That was an unnecessary waste of resources. Destruction of evidence hearings, $8,000 was knocked off there. My clients received $20,000 or $30,000 in discounts. So she was careful. If you read her four-page order on attorney's fees, it was appropriate for her at that time to clarify that she found the claims to be intertwined and that the attorney's fees were appropriate. I thank you for your time today. It looks like I am out of time.
Thank you, Ms. Goodrow.
Thank you.
Mr. Walker, you have about a minute left.
Thank you. Your Honor, to say that the Shells weren't required to hire RG when they're ordered to pay, RG being the engineer for the McCulleys, when they're ordered to pay everything that RG charges just doesn't make any sense. And Judge Boris makes an excellent point that what happens if they're determined to be improper? Who pays for the McCulleys? I think it's far from clear. We paid RG. Do we have to sue RG to get these back? Do we move the trial court to have the McCulleys pay? This is a conflict of interest.
So does the trial court not have the authority to hear your complaints and order McCulley's or their engineer, RG, to reimburse you?
No, I think the trial court does have the authority to do that. We objected to the engineer, and the trial court denied that objection. To say that now the trial court can order them to pay us when RG is out there doing work right now, and we're not exactly sure what they're doing, is just not, it's not fair, it's not equitable, and it is an abuse of discretion. And I'm out of time.
I'm not sure I understand. So what you're arguing, first of all, is the court abused its discretion when it directed the McCulleys or permitted the McCulleys to make a reasonable selection of an engineer. You're saying that was an abuse of discretion.
Yes.
And then the McCulleys chose RG to be their engineer. And the court later in February of 2011 said that it was okay for them to use RG. Am I correct?
Yes.
Now that order's not in front of us though, is it?
I think it is.
You do? Okay. So your original order to us, your original appeal to us was in 2010, I believe, was it not?
Let me just look at the notice.
Well, your amended notice is February 25, 2011, and your original notice, we have a notice of cross appeal. So it's your position that the judge's order regarding the selection of RG is before us?
It is, yes.
And so then as far as whether that is a reasonable selection, the standard of review on that is that you want us to conclude that it was beyond the court's authority to conclude that the selection of RG was reasonable?
I think the standard on that is an abuse of discretion.
Okay, so an abuse of discretion to conclude that RG is a reasonable selection?
Yes.
And then as far as the costs of RG, you've already fronted some money?
Yes.
And the court is still in a position to look at RG's costs and hear your arguments that they have spent too much.
I believe the court can do that if it wants to, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walker. Thank you again, Ms. Kiddo. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect an opinion to issue in due course.